So Nicola, one of the big names that jumps out to me in the exhibition is the Drummonds. Now, my understanding is that there's a bit of an interesting backstory here to the Drummond Earl of Perth, and are you able to kind of elaborate on that?
Well, I think what we've, what I've been doing since we've been the exhibition's been running is sort of looking more closely into some of the stories and other things that come up. Partly that's because the family tree, the big family map, is up in the AK Bell Library. Mm-hmm. People are coming in to look at that and find family names, Strathallan and Drummond and all these kinds of things. So, and we've been getting some of the books out in there in the library. All of these families have family, generally they have family histories that have been written over decades, where people have gone through the family archive and drawn out bits of letters and basically told their own story. These are great books, they're absolutely brilliant. You've got to be wary, of course, because they're written by the family themselves, so sometimes they put in the good bits and don't always, you know.
There's a bit of celebrating success in there.
Absolutely, but they can be quite true to what's actually happened and a good depiction. So I was looking at Drummond because I don't know a huge amount about the Drummonds, actually. They've not been a family that I've really focused on, because I found this book, which is actually, it talks about the mystery of the Duke of Perth, a historical enigma. And I started doing a wee bit of work online and seeing if this was just one book or if there was a kind of story. So the main thing is that Drummond was the sixth Earl, mm-hmm. James Drummond. He's born around 1713 at Drummond Castle. He's the eldest son of the second Duke of Perth, also James, and Jane, who was daughter of the first Duke of Gordon. So they had been closely associated with the Stuarts for several generations, so they were very keen on the Jacobite cause. Perth was brought up at Drummond Castle, but his father's in exile, and then he's sent abroad for his education, and he returns to Scotland around 1730. Mm-hmm. He's got various good features. He's a very amiable man. He's very well read. He talks in broad Scots, apparently. I think that's quite unusual.
Considering he was educated
way, he likes his Scots. He likes to use broad Scots, which I think is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll see in family letters, you'll see words that are spelled out as if they were being said in a Scottish way.
Yeah.
If you see the word party, it might have an I in it, perty, or feather. You know, sometimes you see that in women's letters, so it maybe gives you an indication of how they speak. But that's one little nugget there. But he comes back, and he is one of the first to send support for Charlie when he arrives in Scotland. Uh-huh. Only Prince Charlie landing in Scotland 1745. And the government are worried about this. They know that the Drummonds will be there. Mm. So he's very young, and some people dismiss him as being a bit silly and youthful and all the rest of it.
But yeah, and then you've got somebody coming back from another country who's like heir to like a bit of land
and he have the following, really, that you know, somebody who'd been, you know, there from his birth, you know, because of this travelling. But he's given a post with the Jacobite army alongside the older and far more experienced Lord George Murray.
And see, when he was given a post, is that something that Bonnie Prince Charlie did?
Yes,
just kind of gave titles.
Yes, and he would have arranged that. So they're both at Preston Pans, the Battle of Preston Pans, where the Jacobites defeat the government force. And Perth led the right-wing brigade, apparently, and Murray commanded the left-wing, so they're both there. And then, of course, there's this retreat, of course, back.
That's all on the
march into England, and then, of course, back to Culloden, and then the defeat. So Perth's involved in all of that all the way through. Mm-hmm. And apparently he is, he's part of the Battle of Culloden, but he's wounded and he is unwell at the end of the battle. And there are versions of him being, you know, seen getting on the ship to France. Mm-hmm. He's escaping after mm-hmm. Culloden. But physically, he's apparently always been of a delicate constitution. And the high physical toll of all of this had taken its toll on him. So he apparently succumbs to a fever on the ship while sailing to France. And that apparently is the end of him. That is it.
And you think that's the story.
And that's the story. Story ends. But as I say, looking through books and doing a wee bit of digging around in the library at the AK Bell, I came across this book where someone believes that he didn't go to France at all. The plot thickens. He did not go on a ship. He actually travelled south and ends up in Sunderland, near Sunderland.
That's very, a bit random.
Very, very random.
Yeah.
He takes shelter there with the family, a man called John Armstrong, apparently, and he's invited to lodge there.
Okay.
And he accepts this offer and just basically lies low.
So why do you think he did this? I mean, do you think he faked his own death, well, or do you think he was getting away from, you know, maybe prosecution and execution?
Well, obviously, the aftermath of Culloden is brutal. I mean,
yeah,
the plans are put down. You know, there is a lot of reprisals, and there's an awful lot of people who are, you know, they just don't return. They're not seen again.
Yeah.
Whole families, swathes of land. You know, it is brutal. I'm not quite sure we always get the brutality of that period as well, and the fear people must have had, and he himself would have been destined for living in exile at that time. His lands would have been taken by the forces, the government forces. He would have been attainted, you know, that would have been his lot. So apparently he lives with this family. He doesn't go off on a ship. He lives with this family, and he meets this man, John Armstrong, and falls in love with his beautiful daughter.
Naturally.
There's a love affair at the heart of it. So her name's Elizabeth, and they marry in around 1749, apparently. And they just live in this local area. Apparently the local squire is a man called Lambert, and he makes himself known to James and Elizabeth and says that he knows he is the Earl of Perth, the Duke of Perth.
Okay.
But he is aware that he needs to be remain hidden, and he's no threat to them. He's quite happy for them to live peaceably. And he sets them up in the local boathouse where James, the Duke of Perth, becomes a ferryman rowing people across the
river. Bit of a dramatic change
of life.
But at the same time, if you're going from being like the Earl of Perth to being a ferryman, nobody's really going to expect you to do that. And that's, you know, it's the perfect cover. It's the perfect
hidden and live with the love of your life.
Yeah.
And just, so it's quite strange, but they go on to have children. They go on to have a daughter and a son, and it's the son James. It's his son Thomas, James's grandson, who will actually make a claim to the title at a later date. But it's just difficult to kind of, you know, see what the evidence is. And the big thing that happens in 1771 is that there are a major flooding on the River Weir, and the family papers and much of the proof that the Bidick Duke, that's what he gets called, the Bidick Duke, has, are washed away and lost.
So the evidence is gone, allegedly.
All the evidence that would help him make a claim to his lands in Scotland have gone. And that's a big blow. So, and his family seem to marry. His son marries, his daughters are fine. I mean, and he himself dies in 1782. Mm. And it's not actually until 1826 that the grandson, Thomas Drummond, begins a legal attempt to have himself recognised and as heir to the Perth lands.
And was he successful?
No, ultimately he is
because
not.
Of the missing papers.
Well, there's no evidence. Yeah. Apparently there's a couple of things, but there's no evidence. And he I think he has a moment where people are supporting him, but then it has to go to the House of Lords and the case falls flat. There's no record of it, apparently, which again is quite dubious when you think of all the records that you do have. It's very strange that one case possibly doesn't have a surviving record.
So it's definitely isn't one for conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, ever so slightly. So apparently that Thomas as well, he could be quite sociable and occasionally took a drink. So he liked to give out in the local pubs and hostelries about his noble lineage, but I'm not quite sure.
Tall tales running wild.
Tall tales, perhaps, yeah. So it's a really interesting story. And as I say, there's a whole book on it. And there are other publications. Other things have been published over time. Publications about the parish, actually, which allude to this story and talk about it in quite a formative way. Mm-hmm. That, you know, there's all this evidence and these people were here. And there is a grave. That's what started the author of the book.
Okay.
Alludes to that there was a grave of the Duke, apparently lost at sea, but no, he is buried in a cemetery near the River Weir, near Bidick. So that's really interesting as well. And again, it's family history, which is what we do here in the library. It's what we like, all those kind of stories. I think when family history, you know, people do their own family histories, and we're always looking for something interesting to come up. But of course, in noble families, it gets even more dramatic. People who, you know, claim to be descendants of lords and nobles.
Yeah.
That's very common. We love that. We love getting people in who say, I think I can trace my relatives back. You know, that's always quite good.
So do we have, I mean, do we know what happened to the family since like the 1820s?
Well, apparently the ones who survive live quite sort of average lives. It's just this Thomas who makes the claim, and then there is no further claim on the Perth lands. And of course, the Drummond family carries on through another line because our Duke did die on the ship. But there is a wee aside that the Duke made journeys back to Perth, Perthshire, to come home and see the old family place.
Yeah.
And there's lovely accounts of that. I mean, again, those must be passed down through the family. But in one case, he actually comes back, and upon arriving at Drummond Castle, I'm quoting here, he asked the housekeeper if he could see the apartments. And the housekeeper, apparently, she's an old servant of the castle, looked at his face, and instead of telling him as a sort of beggar or somebody to get lost, she starts to hum the Duke of Perth's Lament. And then she shows him the apartments of the house, and she gets very emotional about that as well. So that's him being recognised by old retainers who know who very well who he is. So, but I think that's, these are kind of the stories.
Yeah, and in those days, you know, you don't have Instagram, you don't have the press chasing you. It's just it's easier to be a bit more discreet when you're kicking around visiting the old family home.
Exactly.
And if you're maybe a wanted man as well.
You're a wanted man, yeah. So I think those stories kind of give a wee bit more, I don't know, it makes something more of the story overall. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'd love to know if there's any more. The book is fairly well researched by the look of it. Somebody's done quite a bit of work. And like I say, even a little bit of searching online. But it hadn't come up in one of the family histories. And sometimes the families allude to these things. If the family history has somebody who makes a claim, they will fight that legally, or they will do whatever is necessary. It's just a nice... What happens after Culloden?
Yeah.
What happens to these people? We get to Culloden and we kind of stop, you know. But really, how did these families survive, and what carries on?
And I think that's the really good thing about the exhibition, is that we look at the different families and the different stories from the area. It's not just about the battle that happens, it's the aftermath and what happens to all these families.
And actually the places too, because what we're trying to do is encourage people to explore Perthshire. Mm. We've partnered up with all of these families and clans and little museums and people who have collections. So it's possible to go out. We were talking in one of the other podcasts about the burning of Strathearn. So this is a locality for Drummond Castle.
Okay.
Yep, you can go out by Muthal and up that road to Creef, where lots of these things happened. And Drummond Castle Gardens are open to the public. They have a website, and they encourage visitors. They've got lots going on there.
Excellent.
The gardens, I think, date from this period as well, so they're very old and are very beautiful and well worth a visit. So you'd be in an actual Jacobite garden that maybe the Bidick Duke visited himself and saw once he returned from Sunderland. Who knows?
But interesting.
Very interesting.
Okay.
So, but we're just trying to encourage that and get people to go and see. And if anyone knows anything more about the Bidick Duke, well, I think we'd be happy to hear from them.
Yeah, definitely. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter. It's at CPK Museums, on Facebook, Perth Museum. And you can also email into the marketing team, marketing@culturepk.org.uk. And we can forward on your email into the local family history team.
Love to hear more.
Mm-hmm.